82 years ago in Forest, Mississippi, a boy named Donald Triplett was born, who was destined to become the first child in history diagnosed with autism. But that was only after his mysterious behaviors led his parents on a love-driven journey to understand why their son was different from other children and how he could be helped. It would take them years of patient determination and one extraordinary clinician before the diagnosis of autism was even conceived. Since then, recognition of autism has traveled far and grown exponentially, becoming ultimately the most talked about diagnosis of our day. In A New History, John Donvan and Karen Zucker unfold the full decades-long narrative, The Story of Autism, as a series of dramatic episodes never told before with such power. Some are dark, children in institutions being shocked with electricity and fed LSD, mothers being told that they were the cause of autism, and even a father killing his autistic son out of the desperate thought that he'd be better off dead. The name of the book is In a Different Key, The Story of Autism, and we welcome John Donvan and Karen Zucker to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
The pleasure is ours.
Thank you very much for having us.
John, let us begin with you of how this project came about.
Well, it's actually personal in a way for both of us because we both have families which have been touched by autism, but we're also journalists too, and we were stunned to discover when we started looking into autism's past, and we did that because we've been covering autism together as a team for ABC News for a long time. We were stunned at the kinds of really both inspirational and sometimes harrowing stories that we discovered there as we learned that 30, 40, 50 years ago, people who were diagnosed with autism were treated very, very poorly by society, and how hard their families fought to give them a place in the world and how successful they were.
And Karen, your son was diagnosed with autism in 1996, and 3 years later you started this work of looking into it and reporting on the social and medical and legal aspects of autism.
Right. John and I had been a team as journalists working together on more mainstream stories, and at some point we just sort of said we should hit this beat and start to focus on it because there was so little out there. The first story we did was a half hour long, and almost nothing had ever been reported at the network on autism before. It's remarkable when you look back just 16, 17 years ago how little we talked about autism even.
Why do you think that was the case?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that what was seen as autism, what was considered autism even 15 years ago, was narrower than it is today. People were given the autism label when their behaviors were so intense that they actually interfered with their lives. People who could not speak were people who had autism. Of course, there were people with autism who could speak, but their speech interfered with typical communication with people. They were limited, in other words, sometimes by physical health issues, but also by a very, very profound inability to relate socially to other people. And, you know, the classic sort of example would be a child who never speaks, who never seems to want to interact with other people, or even a character like Rain Man. So it was a narrower definition, number one. And number two, people who had that condition, they were kind of hidden. They were invisible. Parents were told in those days, and told with a sense of shame, to keep their children in institutions, or at least to keep them at home. And so people didn't want to see people with autism until 15 or 20 years ago, and weren't welcoming them, weren't celebrating them in any way whatsoever. And that began to change, we would say, probably around the time that we started reporting on autism.
Asperger's syndrome had just come out as a description for a variant of autism in 1994 in the United States. So it was really the early days of an awareness of people who were, let's say, higher functioning, for lack of a better word, and people who were able to speak for themselves and express their feelings of having autism.
So, Karen, bring me back to the first diagnosis, which comes around World War II, 1943. It is a Baltimore physician by the name of Leo Kanner who makes the first use of the term autistic, of autistic traits. How did that come about?
Right. Well, his first case was Donald Triplett. He was case number one. And he had been actually, Dr. Kanner had been working with this family of Donald's for years before the actual diagnosis came out. And he was following a group of children and seeing these similar traits that he had never seen before. And it took years of research on his part because he knew there was something different about these kids. And he finally concluded that it was what we now call, you know, autism spectrum.
And John, it should be noted that as Karen mentioned, the first diagnosis was Donald Triplett. You do profile him in the book. He is still alive.
Yeah, Donald's alive, and he's a friend of ours. He's 82 years old as we speak, still lives in a town called Forest, Mississippi, where he was born and grew up. And even though, it's really interesting, even though Donald was, in a sense, the template for the diagnosis of autism, he himself has done really, really well in life. He just continued to grow and thrive. His language skills got better and better. His social skills got better and better. He ended up going to high school late, you know, a few years after everybody else. He went to college, and it took him 5 years, not four, and he was older than everybody else. But at his own pace and rate, he grew. He kept growing to the point where today, you know, he drives a car, something he learned to do in his late 20s. He plays golf, something he started in his 20s. He travels around the world on his own. He has friends. And he's loved in this little community. And it's our feeling, Joe, that part of the reason he did so well was that this community really did a remarkable thing for the time, and that is that they embraced him. As different as he was, they folded him into their daily lives and made him, you know, not feel excluded. They treated him and protected him even. And we know that because when Karen and I started going down to Forest many years ago and investigating the story of Donald Triplett, when we found out he was still alive, people would say to us, yeah, we'll talk to you about Donald, but if you hurt this guy in any way, we know where to find you. And it was a remarkable thing for us to hear that. But it also told us maybe that one of the reasons Donald's life turned out so well is because he was given an environment where he could really flourish.
And we also think that if you could bottle the support that this community gave to Donald, you know, outside of Forest, Mississippi, that the world would be, you know, a much better place for people who are different, any type of differences.
It is fascinating, and I want to get a little bit more into that in how we embrace this in a moment. But I also want to go back to the timeline, because we're looking at 1943 when that first diagnosis came. But you make the case in the book that autism existed for decades, if not centuries, before.
We think. We want to be careful about it. I think that Karen and I in our guts definitely think that autism existed before. We just think that things don't change that fast. We don't think that there's strong evidence that something happened in the 20th century to suddenly cause autism to happen. We think it's much more likely that these traits and people who have these traits have been with us all along, and that it was merely recognized. A lot of the whole question of autism is, what do you recognize? What do you see that's in front of your eyes, and how do you interpret it? Now, that said, we don't think that we can say that we have proven, or anyone has proven, that autism was there before, because before the diagnosis existed, nobody was marking it down. Nobody, when I say existed, I mean before the concept had been coined, nobody was out there studying cases of autism, obviously. And so what we've done is we've gone back and looked at reports of people, and we've said, you know what, they sound a lot like people we know today who have autism. And you know what, we think that if we could see them today, we think it's very likely that they would be diagnosed with autism. So we just want to be careful in saying we haven't proven it. It's pretty much unprovable, but we come down on the side of really strongly suspecting that autism has always been with us.
Karen, you mentioned a moment ago about Donald Triplett and the community that came around him and protected him in many ways. The opposite to that is the very cold and as you say, destructive phrases that were used, such as refrigerator mother, as a theory of autism. Talk a little bit about how that also dates back to the late 40s and really comes to fruition in the 60s.
Well, what's remarkable is that that everybody bought into this theory, that it was the parents, or and particularly the mother's fault, that the child had autism, that it was a psychological, that the parents had damaged and the mother had damaged their child. And really, the parents were the ones who were the only people who were trying to help their children at that time. The very first person who spoke about it was, in fact, Dr. Leo Connor. He spoke about it in an article in Time magazine. But it was Bruno Bettelheim who sort of took that thought and ran with it for decades. And it wasn't until Bernie Rimland did real research to be able to prove that that was just a theory.
And the theory being, John, that the mother would be so cold to the child that the child would then retreat to escape,
right,
and would go into a separate world.
Yeah, Joe, retreat's exactly the word. It was they called it a defense mechanism, that the child found the world created by his mother so stressful and so traumatic that he or she constructed this emotional wall behind which they retreated, and they felt safer living in a world where they didn't have to communicate and where everything was the same every day. And by that I mean kids with autism in that classic sense, as it was diagnosed 50, 60 years ago, they had a very, very strong need for sameness. They didn't like it if the furniture was moved. They had to walk on the same path every day. They had to wear the same socks every day. If they were upset if their furniture was moved in the house, they needed everything to be the same. And so the theory was, well, the sameness is like a sort of safe place that they've constructed for themselves because their mothers were so awful to them. And what's, as Karen said, what's so remarkable is everybody bought into it. I mean, the entire psychiatric establishment bought into it. And when women went to doctors who were aware of autism in the 50s and 60s, knew the concept, what they knew is that the mothers blamed it. So the mothers would come in with their children and say, something, my child is not acting the way I think I'm expecting him to act. What's going on? They would say, well, you did this to him. And then the mother would say, well, what am I supposed to do? And the treatment that was prescribed was intensive psychotherapy for the mother, so that she could figure out what she had done wrong and try to do the opposite. And women spent hundreds and hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars getting themselves psychoanalyzed to figure out why they had caused autism in their children. It's a heartbreaking disaster. And it went on for years, 25 years.
You write about Rita Tepper and Audrey Flack. These were two mothers who raised children with autism during this time period. And Karen, it seems it's such a story of not only being incredibly insulting, but really frustrating for these women.
Yeah, well, what's interesting is these two women had different takes on it. Audrey really just never bought into it. She just knew it wasn't her fault. And Rita, who was a woman who worked in the field, had read Bruno Bettelheim's book, so she knew, oh my gosh, this is my fault. I've done this. And so she believed it as somebody who had been educated about it, and this must be what it is, so I have to figure out, what did I do wrong? You know, I thought my son looked like a little chicken. And so this is part of how this issue continued to move forward, because mothers, in some way, if they believed that they caused it, then maybe there was a way they could fix it. And that's part of what enabled it to go on for years and years, because if you think that you've done something wrong and you can fix it, well, then you can help your child. But if it's not you, and today it's still, we don't have the answers. That was a great excuse for everybody to buy into.
and not work on other ways of looking at autism. I mean, research, real research, didn't happen during those 25 years because everybody already had the answers. It was mom's fault.
It's remarkable because these are the same mothers who helped close down the institutions, and these are the same parents who opened schools for children with autism when they weren't allowed in the schools and fought for their rights to be able to be in a classroom. These are the same people that changed the world, essentially, for children with autism. So how it just doesn't make any sense that these people would be the cause of it. They were the fighters for their children.
And you do make that point in the book, John, that it really is the parents who caused so much change, not only in definition, but also in the civil rights battles that were waged on behalf of people with autism that took place really beginning in the 70s.
I would say that's a very big theme of In a Different Key, that it's a civil rights battle. It was a civil rights campaign fought initially and almost entirely by parents of the children who had no allies. The medical establishment thought they were harm causers. The educational world did not want to know about their children. They were really being pressured to put their kids into institutions. Many did so, in fact. But it was the parents who started to say, look, these children have a right to a place in the world, and that right depends on education. And so that became a very important pivotal point or pressure point, were battles to force schools to take their kids, to take on a responsibility to educate their kids. And schools in those days could and did legally reject children who had autism from any education whatsoever. They said, your child is deemed uneducable, and so, sorry, he has or she has no right to an education. So these parents fought a civil rights campaign to change the laws requiring the public schools to give education to their children. It took about 20 years. Some kids missed out because they were too old by the time the opportunity came along. But all of the kids today who are on the spectrum, who are getting special services in school, are there because of these, to us, hero parents, anonymous hero parents, amateurs at politics, who got into this while raising their kids with autism and really changed the world.
We are talking to the authors John Donovan and Karen Zucker. Their new book is In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. It is published by Crown. We will continue our conversation after this short break. Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. Emmy Award-winning correspondent John Donovan and Peabody Award-winning television news producer Karen Zucker join us. They're talking about their new book, In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. The book weaves together largely unknown stories of previously unsung heroes whose ingenuity, perseverance, and resilience offer new insight into some of the seminal moments of the past near century. The rise of the disability rights movement, deinstitutionalization, the effort to mainstream those on the spectrum, breakthroughs in neuroscience and our understanding of the mind, and the birth of the neurodiversity movement. In our second part of our conversation with John Donovan and Karen Zucker, we look at the term autism spectrum and the history of that particular term.
We really start using it around 1990. And it was a deliberately chosen construct as a way to see autism, almost the way you can look at the sky and see a lot of stars and you can arrange them into pictures. And I am not the originator of that metaphor for autism. There's a writer in The Atlantic who used it very recently, but it's a great one because autism very much is in the eyes of the beholder, and the definition has changed many times again and again. But a psychiatrist in London named Lorna Wing, who was, again, another kind of hero parent, but she was also a professional and an activist and a researcher, came up with this idea based on research she did by going house to house to dozens and dozens and dozens of homes in around London where children were registered with the health service, and their records show that they had autistic traits, and she went to see all of these kids on nights and weekends, taking down data and putting together this idea that autistic traits didn't just show up in the kinds of children like Donald we were talking about earlier in a very sort of intense form, but they could appear much more mildly or in different combinations with people who were of very high intelligence, very average intelligence, below average intelligence, that it was a much broader idea. And so she came up with the concept of the spectrum, which is the idea that autism shows up in all kinds of ways and all kinds of people, almost to the point where the traits exist in people who are quote unquote normal. And it's become a very influential idea since she coined it. And so influential that today the official diagnosis for autism in the American Psychiatric Association's manual on disorders is called autistic spectrum disorder. That's been the case since 2013. And it has a lot of implications. One of the implications is that it includes under that word autism many, many, many more people than it used to. And so it's been very, very influential and has many implications because of that.
And Karen, it, correct me if I'm wrong, but it isn't ultimately clear that the behaviors that are considered autistic have the same origins or will follow even the same course in life. Because there is a spectrum that the core causes do not have to necessarily be the same.
Well, we don't know the answer to that, but what we do know is, you know, and there's a saying that goes in the autism community, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism, because the range, autism is defined behaviorally. And so, as John said before, it's sort of it's something in the eye of the beholder to decide, you know, what that is. And so the spectrum is huge, but the behaviors, there is some thread that is repetitive that connects them, and it's that it's a social disorder.
But we do raise in the book the question of whether we should be thinking about multiple autisms in the plural, whether there are many autisms and not just one autism spectrum. And we don't know the answer to that yet because we don't really have an explanation for the causes. But Joe, the sense I took from your question was, what if we find out through more research that autistic behaviors have many, many different causes? Will we start thinking of those as separate syndromes? Because, you know, the way that we do with any sort of thing where we understand a cause and effect, when we know a cause, we tend to separate that from things that don't have the same cause.
Right.
And so we don't know at this point because the research isn't there, because the definition is still so big and vague and woolly, and because the research is still so preliminary and may never get there. But we don't know if we will end up in a world where we'll be saying, well, this guy has, you know, this kind of autism, and it's really not the same as that kind of autism. And maybe the lumping them together under a spectrum may seem eventually to be less useful, but we're not at that point yet. We're at the point where, probably because we don't know about separate causes, the spectrum idea and lumping people together is kind of the most useful way we have at present for understanding everybody.
You talk in the book about how we got to this idea or notion that there was an autism epidemic. And you, as you just said, we don't know about these multiple causes. We also don't know about that, right? It's not clear as to whether we have an epidemic.
Well, part of that is because the numbers keep changing, and apparently they continue to rise, but they're rising in a way where we're not counting the same things. We keep changing the definition. Everything about autism has not ever remained the same. So when you're looking at it and you're talking about it and you're trying to figure out, are there more people, you really can't, because you've changed what defines what autism is. And that goes through the history of autism. From the very first person, Victor Lauder, who did the first count of people with autism in the world, to today, they're not counting the same things anymore. So the question of an epidemic is in some ways not as important as that we care for and we provide services and that we deal with the fact that there are a lot of people with autism and there are a lot of children with autism, and we've been looking at that for a while. But now we need to start to look at that these children with autism are growing up and becoming adults. And so those are the things that are more important to kind of focus on, because we can't say for sure. Are there more people than ever before? We don't know. We think that there were probably a lot of people that were not diagnosed, but we don't know, and it almost doesn't matter all that much.
How much damage did the vaccine controversy do where it was believed that vaccines caused autism?
A lot. Because we think in the beginning, back in the late 90s when the question was first raised, it was a legitimate question. And it was a legitimate question because there wasn't a clear answer to it at that point. And it was a real experience that a lot of families had, where they had a child diagnosed and then soon after that they had a child vaccinated and soon after that the child was diagnosed with autism. And those two things happened very close together in time. And of course, you make the link in your mind that these two things have something to do with each other. That you don't have to be crazy or ignorant to think that. I would. But then science comes in on the question and begins to look at these cases and the big picture, and that's the way you have to do it. Broadly speaking, when you look at a population, is autism occurring at a higher rate in places where people are vaccinated in such and such a way? Well, the science made it really clear. The answer is no. The answer is just no. And the problem with the years that were spent dealing with the vaccine issue, a few of them, one is it took an awful lot of energy and attention away from more important work that had to be done in the autism community, and took a lot of attention away from research that was not about vaccines. And there was a lot of research done on vaccines. And secondly, it eroded trust in science generally. And third, it got people to the point where they were scared of vaccines. And we know the impact is that in some communities, vaccination rates have dropped low enough so that there are outbreaks of diseases like measles that used to be considered gone. So all in all, it was an unfortunate episode, but driven at the beginning by a concern that we think deserved attention in the beginning, but also when the answer came along, that deserved attention too.
One of the things that is so really incredible in the book is that you make the point that well into the 1990s, autism was still a condition with a very low profile. And with that low profile came virtually no scientific research that was being done on autism, which seems just unimaginable.
Well, part of that was, again, it was connected to the vaccine issue, because people, I think, and this is, you know, part of what you saw is that I think that scientists were afraid to sort of touch that, because the vaccine issue was so complicated at the time. But then there were a group of parents who, two families that decided, you know what, we need science. The only way we're going to figure out what's going on with autism is to bring science into the research, and scientists. And these two families literally changed the globe, because they brought people in who had never considered doing any kind of research for autism before. And we're talking, it's almost 20 years later now, there is a huge field of research. And it's still taking so much time to figure it out, because it's such a complicated disorder.
As we wrap up, what ultimately do we know now about treatment? And one of the takeaways, at least for me in the book, is, and I assume you both agree with this, that we still have a long, long way to go.
Well, and as Karen said, the long way to go is where it comes to adults. And treatment is a very, very broad term, and it can mean anything from occupational therapy to a therapy called applied behavior analysis. But treatment also kind of comes down in a really important way, we think, to the other word, the other way that we mean the word treatment, and that is, how do we treat people in our communities who have autism? How welcoming are we to those people? And we tell a story near the end of the book about a young man who was riding a bus in New Jersey a few years back, and he has autism. And he's a person who has autism who can't speak. And it's remarkable that he's even riding the bus on his own because he had to be taught how to do that. And he's riding on the bus alone, and he starts making some noises that aren't, you know, verbal sounds that are loud, and he starts rocking back and forth in his seat. And right behind him, two guys start picking on him, and they start saying to him, "Hey, you know, buddy, you know, what's your problem? What's wrong with you, man? What's your problem?" And just as that happens, another passenger stands up and approaches these two guys, and he had seen this kid on the bus before, this young man on the bus before. He approaches the two guys, and he says, "What's his problem? He's got autism. What's your problem? Why don't you just back off?" And at that moment, the whole bus lined up with that young guy on the bus. And if our book has a message, it's we need more people to do what that guy on the bus did who stood up, and we need fewer people to be those two guys on the bus picking on him. That treatment comes down to how are we going to treat people who are different, who are in our community. So what that the guy made some noise and rocked back and forth in his seat? Let's roll with that. Let's not pick on people for that. Let's make room for people who may not, you know, fit, you know, the round pegs in the square holes, because there are a lot of them. There are a lot of them, from people who have very mild autistic traits to much more intense autistic traits. And that's kind of what where we want to leave readers with our book, who read our book, is wanting to be that guy who stands up and wanting to be part of the solution. And when it comes down to treatment, to understand that treatment for autism also comes down to that, how we treat people who have autism.
To us, it is the heart and soul of the book. It's respecting and accepting and making people who are different just be accepted for who they are and be part of the community.
The name of the book is In a Different Key, The Story of Autism by John Donovan and Karen Zucker. The book is published by Crown. John, Karen, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe, so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is In a Different Key, The Story of Autism. It is published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.